Senate Transportation Committee to order. Let the record note that it's February 22nd and 1 p.m. On today's agenda, we have the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, another budget presentation, and we have Ms. Ellison who's going to be making the presentation today. Here she comes. All right. Commissioner Ellison, welcome to the committee. And
thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm acting commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. We're going to be reviewing some similar material to what we reviewed the last time we were here, just to give an overall view again of the transportation divisions within public safety. And then we're going to now talk about the governor's proposed budget. The DPS mission is to protect citizens and communities, prevent, prepare, respond, recover, educate, and enforce. Focus on saving lives, providing efficient and effective services, maintaining public trust, and developing strong partnerships. The divisions under this committee's jurisdiction within the Department of Public Safety include the Minnesota State Patrol, Driver and Vehicle Services, Office of Traffic Safety, Office of Pipeline Safety, which is within the State Fire Marshal's Office, and Administrative and Related Services. Basically, the budget summary, again, for the transportation divisions, the governor is requesting $303.9 million from all funds for the 12-13 biennium. For fiscal year 12-13, the budget represents a 0.3% decrease from the 10 and 11 biennial budget, which reflects changes to the forecast base as well as the budget change items, which I'll go over in a few minutes. The budget change items, and I'll go into more detail as we go through the presentation, but they include a police and firefighter health care reimbursement program, some changes to that, an extension of the driver and vehicle services technology surcharge, and the armor maintenance and operations change item. We're covering that here mainly because we provide the funding from the 911 fee that goes to the Department of Transportation for building out the armor system. And so we want it to stay consistent in that. I'm sure you'll hear from MnDOT about this budget change items in their presentations. The 12-13 governor's budget recommendations for all transportation divisions include $20,812,000, or 7% from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, 57% or $171,736,000 from the Trunk Highway Fund, a general fund appropriation of 4% or $13,174,000, and miscellaneous special revenue of $98,176,000, which is 32%. And again, that miscellaneous special revenue largely includes the 911 fee that we all pay on our cell phones and landlines that is used for the 911 system and the armor radio communication system. The budget expenses for 2012-13 by category: payments to individuals are $1,064,000. That includes reimbursement to police officers for bulletproof vests within that account. Transfer to other funds of $4,236,000. General operating, which is everything other than compensation, includes $76,088,000, or 25% of our budget, and compensation is $222,510,000, which is 74% of our budget. Administration and related services, that is included in your budget book on pages 19 to 28, in case you want to follow along in the budget book. And that area includes the Office of Communications, the Commissioner's Office, our Human Resources Division, Fiscal and Administrative Services, and the Office of Technology and Support Services. The first change item that we want to talk about today is the Police and Firefighter Health Insurance Program, and that's located on page 17 of your budget books. The history on this is that Minnesota Statute 299A.465 requires cities to continue health insurance coverage for peace officers and firefighters and their dependents who are disabled in the line of duty and the dependents in the event that the firefighter or police officer is killed. When that fund was originally established, it was established to reimburse, to require a reimbursement on insurance coverage only for police officers. And under the statute, then later firefighters were added to that purpose area under statute. So now it covers both police officers and firefighters injured or killed in the line of duty. And again, it extends their health insurance if they're disabled and the health insurance of their dependents if they're killed. The state reimburses cities for the health insurance coverage on a prorated basis. Currently, the program is funded at $1.367 million per year from the general fund. This program has grown exponentially in the years. When it was originally created in 1997, it was projected that this would cost about $313,000 per year. The requests to this account now are for $2.7 million a year. And we have many, many more police officers and firefighters who are eligible to receive this benefit than what was originally projected. So the recommendation is to take the money to continue this program from the special revenue account instead of from the general fund. We'll talk about the Minnesota State Patrol, which is on pages 68 to 79. Their mission is to protect and serve all people in the state through assistance, education, and enforcement, provide support to allied agencies, and provide for the safe, efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota's roadways. The State Patrol has 875 full-time sworn and non-sworn personnel. For the fiscal year 2012-13 biennium, the budget is $166.2 million when you combine all funds. $158,378,000 is from the Trunk Highway Fund, $1,570,000 from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, and $6,290,000 from the General Fund. The State Patrol services include aviation, capital security, executive protection, the canine program, crash reconstruction, commercial vehicle enforcement, the drug recognition expert, the vehicle crimes unit, DWI enforcement, fleet management, investigative services, public information, a training academy, radio communications, a special response team, and then various programs funded under federal grants. Now, last time I was here, we had people come up after the end of each division, but since we went over a lot of that material, I'm going to go ahead and go through the presentation, and we'll bring people up as needed at the end of the presentation for questions. Is that all right, Mr. Chair?
That'll work out just fine, Ms. Eliason.
Next, we have the Office of Traffic Safety, and in the budget book, that's on pages 98 through 101. The vision is to reduce fatalities and serious injuries to zero on Minnesota's roads. Their mission is to lead efforts to prevent traffic deaths and serious injuries by changing behavior on the roadways in Minnesota. For the fiscal year 12 and 13 biennium, they receive $870,000 from the Trunk Highway Fund, and this allows them to meet the match that is required to receive about $37 million in federal funds. The Office of Traffic Safety programs include traffic safety outreach, impaired driving prevention, seatbelt use, child passenger safety, traffic records and data systems, safe road coalitions, motorcycle safety, teen drivers, underage alcohol prevention, distracted driving, traffic safety research and analysis, crash outcome and data evaluation, and fatality analysis record systems. The Towards Zero Deaths Initiative is an ongoing partnership between the Minnesota Departments of Public Safety, Transportation, and Health, and many traffic safety advocates and organizations located throughout the state. The goal is elimination of fatalities and serious injuries from the roads through the application of education, engineering, enforcement, and emergency medical and trauma services. Next, we have driver and vehicle services, and again, in your budget book, that's located on pages 80 to 89. Their mission is they're committed to providing fair, accurate, secure, and timely service through effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, and quality information and technical support for staff and business partners. Driver and Vehicle Services employs 538 people working in 98 locations throughout Minnesota. Fiscal year 12-13 biennium, they have $111.9 million. That includes all funds. $95,468,000 of that is from the Special Revenue Fund, and $16,472,000 from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. Through the Driver and Vehicle Services Division, they collect approximately $950 million in revenue for the state of Minnesota each year. The change item that we have that's related to DVS is located on page 11 of your budget book. Several years ago, we started to undertake a project to completely redo the driver and vehicle services information system that is used by thousands of law enforcement, courts, and other people throughout the state of Minnesota. The system is a 1980s mainframe system. We have to completely redo all of it to come into compliance with what we need to do to share information among our constituents and between Minnesota and the federal government. We had the approval to go ahead and charge a $1.75 surcharge on all DVS transactions to cover the anticipated cost of that system. We are requesting that the end date for the expiration of the $1.75 surcharge be moved to fiscal year 2015 from 2012 so that we can complete the build-out of that new system. DVS services include title and registration, driver examination, driver compliance, driver's license issuance, special plates and disability parking credentials, auto dealer licensing and salvage vehicle inspection, interstate truck licensing and fuel tax, a public information center, and document management and records.
Ms. Lassen?
Yes.
Could we step back just a little bit and talk a little bit more about that $1.75 surcharge on DVS transactions and the desire to extend that to 2015? Just wondering how much is currently in the account to fund the MNLAR system as it was initially proposed, and how far will what we've currently collected get us to completion of the capital costs, which was the original intent of that surcharge?
Mr. Chair, the current amount in the account is a little over $15 million that will be carried over into the next biennium. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I didn't. Did I answer your question, or was there another part?
Then let me rephrase the question. You say that there's $15 million that is being carried over at the current time. What has been the total that has been collected so far that has been used for that capital equipment for the MNLAR system?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Pat McCormick, the Driver and Vehicle Services Director, to answer that question.
Thank you.
We anticipate, if you look at the technology surcharge, we anticipate a total cost to completely redo the system, including everything, staff time, consultants, the vendor, and all of that, of $69,400,000 by the time it's completed. And we currently have $15 million. We're collecting about $1 million a month into that fund. And I'll give you that overview and then turn it over to Ms. McCormick.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And in terms of, Acting Secretary Ellison stated, we have been collecting approximately $1 million a month, a little over $12 million per year. But obviously the project has been started, and so the current balance that I checked with our Division of Fiscal Administration is $27,926,684.42. But of that amount of money,
a little more exact than that.
we want to be exact.
Yeah,
so
thank you very much.
We do have encumbrances that will need to go against this during this fiscal year of approximately $2.57 million. So those are expected to be paid by the end of this fiscal year, and we're also anticipating that before the end of this fiscal year, we'll have to encumber money for the contract that we're in the process of negotiating with the selected vendor for the design and build of our system.
So, Ms. McCormick, if you just hang around for a little bit, I'm trying to get my arms around this myself, but Senator Howe?
Mr. Chair, yeah, could you just explain that last comment when you said that you're going to be working with them? Because it appears we've already spent about $12 million, correct?
Ms.
Mr. Chair and Senator Howe, in terms of the overall project altogether you're talking about, I'm not sure of that number. I've been mainly dealing with just what we currently have and what we have, but I'm sure I can get that number for you.
Mr. Chair, Ms. McCormick, I'm just taking just a little simple math here that we've got $15 million in account. We've raised $27 million so far, so we've obviously spent $12 million. And now you said you're...
Mr. Chair, Senator Howe, we're anticipating that we'll spend another $12 million so that we'll have $15.2 or $15.6 million to carry over.
Okay, so you're expecting... Mr. Chair, you're expecting that. So right now in the fund, you have $27
million? Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Howe, that's correct. That because we have been collecting this money for the last 2 years, and so we have been collecting money, we have been spending money, but the point was to start collecting so that we would be able to have the funding to be able to encumber funds to be able to design and build the system.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator, is that clear? Then we anticipated when we put this budget together that we would have to pay, in addition to what Ms. McCormick referenced as being currently encumbered, an additional $12 million so that we would have 15.6, I believe it is, to carry over into the next years to help with completing the project, in addition to the $1.75 that we hope to raise between now and the end of 2015.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. McCormick.
The other thing I can tell you is during this current fiscal year, we had already expended $2.6 million. But as I said, the project has been underway because as part of this project, we had to be able to scope the project. We had to hire a technical and move business staff to a team that is working on this. We had to write the business requirements, then we had to write an RFP. We had to go through the entire request for proposal process, and we had to evaluate those RFPs that were received, and now we are in the process of negotiating a contract with a selected vendor.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the expected outcome of this?
Is that Olson?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can't see your last name, but
Dibble.
Senator Senator Perry.
Senator Perry. Ms. Olson.
The answer to that question is rather long and involved, but to try to shorten it, the whole driver and vehicle licensing system will be completely rebuilt over the next period of time between now and the end of 2015. We have reviewed, just to get ready for the project, hundreds and hundreds of business practices and looked at everything that we currently do, how to streamline what we're doing, and how to document what we're doing in preparation for the new system. What happened is the system was originally a mainframe system, and it was created in the 1980s before there were laptops. And so what happened is that as time went on and people expected to be able to get information through a web-enabled system, we have had to basically jerry-rig around the mainframe system and build various different interfaces to enable that mainframe system to work in a web-enabled environment. We have thousands of people. The court system relies on the information within this system. Law enforcement relies on it in their squad cars. We have insurance companies that rely on it. Our 98 locations throughout the state and all of our deputy registrars and driver's license agents have to rely on the system, and they have to be able to collect money and have that system assign the money all to the various different accounts within the state of Minnesota in a web-enabled fashion. So what grew as a, what was started as a mainframe system now has to handle all kinds of transactions and flows of information that it can no longer support without risking the whole, the breakdown of the entire system. What's happened since the 1980s also is that the federal government has required more and more of us in terms of providing them with information about drivers. We have the problem driver pointer system. We have to match up people's Social Security numbers. We have to get into a system throughout the nation that looks at motor vehicle title information and make sure that cars that are titled in Minnesota aren't the same car as entitled and there isn't fraud involved. So all of these things have been happening over the years that this system, people in the IT system have had to sort of jerry-rig to make this work. We are now at the point where that system is so fragile that having to add different federal requirements to it puts the whole system at risk. So that's why we decided a couple of years ago to do a pre-design and, again, scope out all that would be needed to complete the project. Basically, the short answer is to bring the driver vehicle information system into the 20th century and beyond so that we can continue to meet all of the mandates and all the information needs that we have and the need to collect money and make sure that money gets to all of the right places. That's a very, I know that's a very long answer, but that's what it involves.
Follow up, Mr.
And Senator Perry, just to I appreciate your questions and your clarification and your discussion about this. I think it's very important for the committee to understand some of the history and how we moved here to this point where we need this MNLAR system. I have a follow-up question, too, but Senator Perry, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With that in mind, and I'm all for technology and getting things into the new century here because there's parts of our government that haven't gotten there yet, but with all of that in mind, obviously it's been proven in the private sector and other companies that have done similar upgrades that it has a downsizing effect on the workforce. With that in mind, have you developed plans to take care of, without reassigning or using all of the efficiencies, have you come up with a program that will help that workforce, which obviously might have to find employment elsewhere?
Ms. Eliason? Mr. Chair, Senator Perry, what we have done, as I mentioned before, we have literally taken a look at all of our business practices and are in the process of changing and streamlining our business practices to work with the new technology and the enhancements that we'll be able to have. We are anticipating that through attrition, we will be changing the type of employees that we have. We don't have projections right now that say we imagine that we're going to have 100 fewer employees in the future than we have now. But as people retire, we need people with different skills. Sometimes we will need fewer people to do the same work. And to get ready for that, again, we're documenting and reworking and documenting all of our business practices. But to say that we have a plan to eliminate 500 jobs or 100 jobs or 20, we don't. It's a matter of changing the work to make it more efficient, and that will likely result in fewer people to do the work, but people will be retiring. We have a large number of our workforce that are projected to retire in the next 5 years.
One last short.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I only bring that up is because, you know, the worst thing that we could do would be to allow you to move forward on this and spend this money knowing the efficiencies that will be there to maintain a workforce that is not needed. And I only bring that up because we know it's a reality, and it's not that we want to eliminate, but as technology grows, it appears it's no different that, I grew up on four tractors on the farm, and the bigger the tractor, the fewer tractors we needed. So I don't necessarily think it's a good idea that we don't have a plan. It's not fair to those that might be affected negatively because of an upgrade. So that was my reason for bringing it up.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Howell.
I just have a couple of questions, Mr. Chair. One is, I know every state is different, but as you look to other states that have went through this process, who out there right now has maybe the best program or transfer of information that you look towards?
Ms. Eliason?
Mr. Chair, Senator Howe, I'm going to answer it just in general terms, and I'm going to ask Ms. McCormick, because she probably has more details than I do. But we have looked at every state that has embarked upon this process of redoing their driver and vehicle system. And you can imagine there are many states that are in the same shape that we're in. The big mistake that we've seen happen, and there have been some systems that have failed, where states have spent lots of money in the systems that failed. And where we see the pattern of the systems that have failed is that they haven't married the business unit with the technology people in terms of working together with the system throughout the whole process. Other states have had the technology people come in and drive it, and technology people are very good at technology, but they're not necessarily good at maybe making that technology work on a practical basis. So what we've tried to do is learn from the mistakes of other states and have the business people who understand the processes that need to occur working hand in hand with the technology people to make it as cost-efficient and practical as possible. And I'll ask Ms. McCormick to answer which state, in her opinion, has the best system.
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Senator Howe, it'd be difficult for me to pick one state that has the best system, but I would say that as Acting Commissioner Ellison stated, we've surveyed numbers of states, and I think one state a couple states have done a really good job in terms of scoping their project and working through their project. Iowa is one state that has been successful in their implementation of their system. Wisconsin has been, but they've been working on theirs for 20-some years and have done it in very slow stages. And they have seemed to be successful. Other states are now, Kansas is almost ready to begin implementing or begin the actual operation of their system. And so those states are all doing good jobs. And in many cases, what states have done is they have done the vehicle and registration system in one, because a lot of states are organized in different fashions than ours are, so that some may have driver license in one department and they may have the vehicle and registration in another department, and so they may only be working on part of it at a time. But in general, the states that have phased it in and have taken the time and had the business staff driving the project, those are the states where there haven't been major problems. What we've learned through those surveys is that we need to obviously have the business involved all the way through the project, which is what we have done. We moved some of our best business managers over to the project. We've had as-is 2B sessions. We have subject matter experts from across the division that have been participating as we wrote the business requirements for the system. And we have, we are also in the process right now of meeting with staff, asking what their questions are and explaining the vision and trying to get staff ready for the changes that will be occurring. across the division. But the other thing I'd like to say is I think we've re-scoped the project since we had some of these discussions with other states, because in some states the implementation was ramped up too quickly. We have learned from mistakes where some states have started a new driver's license system and then have had to totally close it down for months while it was redone because it wasn't meeting the business needs or there was some flaw. In Montana had a major problem with their vehicle registration system and it had to be redesigned and brought back up again. And so we've learned, we've asked a lot of questions. Staff have been, from these other states, have been very generous with their time to discuss these things with us. And I think we believe that through the RFP that we wrote, we have addressed a lot of the concerns that they realized they should have thought through a little bit differently. So I think that's why our approach is very phased in. It means that we are going to keep our current system running as we slowly phase in the various parts of our business. So we're talking vehicle title and registration. We're talking finance and records. We're talking inventory. We're talking driver's license and driver compliance, and we are looking at phasing that in slowly. But in order for us to do that, we have to have most of the software and hardware for the new system completed because we're going to have to operate two systems for a while. And that's one of the main reasons why we're looking at the fact that we will need funding to keep going forward so that we can ensure that we are still able to maintain our business, collect the revenue that we're expected to collect, serve all of our customers, work with deputy registrars, dealers, and driver's license agents, and perform all of our duties. But our systems and most motor vehicle systems are very complex. You have a lot of confidential data. Most of the transactions must be secure. Financial information must be secure. And so it has to be done in a very methodical and phased-in approach.
Just one quick comment.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad to hear that you've reached out to the other states because I think to Senator Perry's point, you know, when you're putting this together, it's very tough to ask a division or somebody to say, you know, do we need to do it the same way? Do we need to design the program? But can we eliminate our division or does it make sense to do this anymore this way? And in the future, are we going to have to do it that way? I know when it came to, you know, GIS at the counties, you know, a lot of them went together and tried to form a coalition to try and get some efficiencies there. And I know each state is a little different, but I'm hoping that, and it sounds like you're learning from other states that maybe the way they do it might be better than what we do here. And I'm glad to hear that you're finding some of the pitfalls there that we can try and avoid. But, you know, I think the biggest thing is if we're investing this kind of money, we should see some kind of not only some payback in the future and efficiencies in the way we do things, and does it make sense to do them anymore just because we've done that in the past? So I appreciate that.
Question I guess I would have is, and I'm still trying to get my arms around how we, for I believe now 4 years, we've had this $1.75 surcharge being accumulated, and we are spending money, and we're at the, we are at this point, going to end it in 2012, but you're asking to extend it for an additional 3 years for an additional $36 million. I'm just trying to understand what happened that would have created such a huge additional expense to what we originally had talked about in supplying the capital needs for this project.
Mr. Chair, I'll start out, and then I'll ask Ms. McCormick to add details as she sees fit. I believe the original surcharge was started 2 years ago, correct?
It started in fiscal year 2009, I think.
Mr. Chair, it started in fiscal year 2009.
Okay, so 3 years into this one.
When we first went forward with the technology fee, we did testify in front of the legislature that we would be coming back once we had done our pre-design and once we had more information on the exact cost of the system and once we would know more about what the system would need in terms of ongoing maintenance for the new system, anticipating that it'll be a little different than what we needed for today. So we were encouraged to put a sunset date of 12, and we did that, but we tried to be clear that at the time we were doing the pre-design, we couldn't project out all of the different costs that were going to be associated with this because we were just embarking on the process. And so we're coming back now. We understand it's a problem whenever you try to extend a surcharge and that there would be lots of questions, and it's reasonable that we should have to explain exactly what we're doing and why we're doing it. But we did indicate that we may need to come back and ask for that sunset to be extended once we got into the pre-design. So we went through 18 months of simply a pre-design and looking at what other states were doing, trying to scope out the extent of the project, trying to bring on new staff and some new contractors to look at, you know, identifying what we need. Then we had to take time to actually put the RFP together, which took another significant period of time because, again, some of the mistakes that other states have made is that they haven't been as clear with exactly what the deliverables should be under each section of the project. And because this is such a large project, it took a lot of time to just even develop the request for proposal. We then put out the request for proposal, and now we're in the process of meeting with the selected vendor, and we are going line by line with negotiating the contract and establishing the deliverables and what is sufficient in terms of the deliverables that are established. And so we just have a much better idea of exactly the costs involved. That's about as honest and clear an answer as I can give you, and I'd ask Ms. McCormick to add whatever she thinks is appropriate.
Ms. McCormick, do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, I think one area that was really sounded out in with dealing with the other states that we were talking to, and that had to do with the cleaning of the data that you need to do before you enter that data bring that data onto a new system. You're talking about our system about 30 years old, and one of the things is that obviously there have been a lot of changes that have been made, just not in the technology, but in the laws and the way we enter data. Oftentimes that data, the documenting of the program wasn't always kept, so that in a lot of cases we've had to do research to make sure we understand what that data means. But what we're trying to do is clean up the data that we have currently on our system, making sure it's consistent so that we have consistently the same information in the same coding throughout the system, so that when we transfer that data to a new system, we're not going to have bad data to start that system with. And that's the one thing we heard in every single state that we talked with, that if it's worth it to spend that time on the front end than to have to face it on the back end. And so that is one cost that I'm not sure that we took into account how extensive it is. And sometimes you don't even realize that till you start really researching it and looking at the data. And we're lucky enough to have long-term staff that understand what that data meant with some laws that may no longer even be in place. So we have these subject matter experts that have been key to us being able to understand it and work hard at cleaning the data up. And so that has been a cost. And then, as I said, the cost of operation of two systems for the amount of time that we'll need was significantly higher when we started getting estimates as to what that would be than what we thought in 2007 and 8 when we were looking at this number that Commissioner Ellison talked about in terms of what we would need to build the system. So I think those are two areas that have really changed in our view during the pre-design and these first couple phases of the MNLARS project.
Well, thank you for the clarification. It's very helpful to go back a little bit and then also to look forward and to have a better understanding of how these costs mount. But what I guess I would like you to further talk about a little bit is at the end of 2015, can you tell us that that surcharge is going to go away and we won't have to tax the people of Minnesota any longer for that amount?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what we anticipated when we first asked for this technology surcharge is that we may have to come back at the end of the project and say there's a certain amount. Certainly it will be reduced. When we first scoped out the project, we envisioned that it would be reduced to a dollar for the ongoing maintenance and upkeep of the system. So I don't want to close the door on us coming back. It certainly will be a reduction from the $1.75. Again, we anticipated that it would go down to a dollar, and we will know more as we progress in the project as to what exactly will be needed.
Thank you. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. On your next slide, you're talking about the services of DVS. It's your next slide. And I don't know if this is the right time to ask about this, if these improvements will impact. I'm getting a lot of calls from constituents about the length of time it's taking them to get their title and registration. And I wondered if, which seems to me to just be a data entry, you know, unless I'm wrong, it's just a matter of entering data and then kicking something out quickly for title and registration. So that it's a complaint of up to 10 weeks or even longer to get that done. I just wondered if you would speak to that and help me understand what the problem is and if this in any way will help with that.
I'm going to ask Ms. McCormick to give you the details on that.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, it is taking a long time. Title transactions, though, are, you know, it looks like it's just data entry, but they can be much more complicated than that. For instance, if there's a brand on the title of the vehicle that was been sold to another owner, we may need to research that. And there is a new federal requirement that we have to check the vehicle history on every vehicle that we issue a title with through the National Motor Vehicle Title Information System. And our staff are able to do that, but the issue is that oftentimes we need to check with another state because if the vehicle was previously located or owned in another state, their branding information, their title information may not be the same as ours in terms of even the terms that are used. And so we have to then contact that state, and oftentimes that can take a day or two to hear back from the other state. It's not an automatic contact like you and I might have on an email. This is where you have to send a message through the National Motor Vehicle Title System to the other state, and then the other state, when they have time, responds to you. That has significantly caused problems in our title turnaround time. In addition to that, we do have an expedited services process that is used, and in that particular case, we do have a quicker turnaround time, but the individual has to pay $20 for that service. So we do have a way that you can get a quicker title, but we're working on solutions. We had a lean event where we looked at our mail registration process and title and registration process to see if there is ways that we could change that process. We're implementing that now to see if that will help us turn it around. But you're talking about the deputies entering some information, but then that information comes to us, and we, because of our old system, we have to re-enter that information into our system, and we may have to add additional information as well as check the National Motor Vehicle Title Information System. So that is a concern, and that's part of the reason that it isn't like a new computer system where you may only need to enter that information once, transmit it to the other office, and then have it audited, and then the title would be issued. So those are some of the problems. But we are having our staff work overtime right now using the money we make from this expedited service so that we can get our title turnaround cut down. We have we have been able to decrease it in the last couple weeks by 15 days, but we have a long way to go, and we're still going to be doing that to see if we can get that number down.
And just one follow-up. Thank you, Senator. Do you have, as a part of your lien practices or other kind of in-house administrative practices, benchmarks that you set for time frames for accomplishing and turning around work? Do you establish a goal that you measure yourself against in terms of turnaround times on something like title and registration?
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, yes, we do. And as a matter of fact, it's unrealistic at this particular time. It is listed in the budget documents as 14-day turnaround time, and that is our goal. At this point, we would like it to get down quite a bit lower than what it is now. I'm not sure we can meet the 14-day turnaround time at the current time, but that is our goal, and that's what we try to do. But I get reports on a weekly basis as to what the title turnaround time is. Our staff are tracking title turnaround time. Our vehicle services program director has a group of individuals on her staff that she's working with to try to reduce the backlog in titles.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, I get those updates weekly as well, as to what the targets are and how close we are to meeting the targets and what we're doing to try to get more towards the target.
I would just make a final comment that I think that it's if you set a target, you do an analysis of what the barriers are to the achievement, and you really drive that, you can bring it down. If you just have the analysis, say the reasons why we can't meet the target, and you don't challenge everybody to come up with maybe a different system or a different process, then you can't move your benchmarks. So I'm hoping that can happen. I'm getting a lot of calls of complaints about this particular issue.
Thank you, Ms. McCormick. Appreciate the input.
Thank you.
Moving on to the Office of Pipeline Safety, pages 102 to 104. Their mission is to protect lives, property, and the environment through the implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident and incident investigations, and education. For the fiscal year 12 and 13 biennium, they have a budget of $13 million in all funds. $2,708,000 is from special revenue, which is derived from inspection fees. And then they also receive $3.6 million in federal funds. They do pipeline inspections, major pipeline project inspections, pipeline incident investigations, enforcement, and damage prevention. The other change item that we want to talk about is the armor maintenance and operation, and I mentioned that because MnDOT is under the purview of this committee, and so, again, that's located on page 13, but we transfer money from public safety to the Department of Transportation for building out the armor system. We collect the 911 fee and, again, transfer some of that money to build out the armor system. The recommendation is for fiscal year 12 to 15, a special revenue appropriation to MnDOT for the armor maintenance and operations. Any other questions from the committee?
Ms. Eliason, could we go back to the Office of Pipeline Safety? I see you have two slides concerning that. Can you give us or is there somebody here that can give us a little more depth as to the number of employees that are in that office? And look, just a little bit better grasp. You know, I know every year we just take a look at this. It's two quick slides, and just wondering about, you know, some efficiencies, where we are on the age of the workforce and moving forward. Are there opportunities there for efficiencies that maybe we should be taking a look at? So, Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please.
Sure. Jerry Rosendahl, State Fire Marshal and Director of Pipeline Safety. In terms of the size of the workforce, I think on page 104 in the bottom, you see kind of reflected the full-time equivalents. And you'll see that a little bit to your changing workforce angle. You'll see back in fiscal year 2010, we were only showing 14 employees. And the issue was we had a couple of retirements, and we had a couple of people that kind of stolen away by either the federal government, the Office of Pipeline Safety, or private industry. We're currently actually at 17 employees and going to 19. Part of the rationale for this situation and this change goes to the federal requirements. We are an interstate agent for the federal government, Pipeline and Hazardous Material Safety Administration. We inspect all of the interstate pipelines in Minnesota. For that, we have financial arrangement where they provide us funding. Along with the funding, of course, comes requirements to inspect to the federal rules, federal laws. And those federal requirements over the last several years have been increasingly more difficult, and they've added more requirements onto that. And to that, as we change the workforce over, we've been increasing the level of education requirement for our, the staff that are coming on. We have the difference between 14 and 19 is quite a number of years in terms of age of the employees that are coming on, because we're getting some young professional engineers fresh out of college, and then we're having to train them in on this situation. So we're moving forward with increased federal requirements, but along with that is has come increased funding from the federal government also. You'll see a blip there in fiscal year 11 as they had additional money they put out to upgrade our equipment and things like that. So I rambled a little bit there. Sorry about that. I'm not sure I got to all your questions, Mr. Chairman.
I think you covered them all in one long paragraph. Thank you, Mr. Rosendahl. Any other questions? Senator Hall?
Mr. Chair, could you speak to, is the Gopher One financed through this, or is that a different?
Mr. Chair and Senator, the Gopher One call system is a separate nonprofit corporation with a board of directors, which I serve on also. But their entire funding stream mechanism is paid for by the utilities that receive the tickets that that they get from anybody of any one of us calling in on a one-call ticket. You know, we're going to dig wherever. So the utilities that have their facilities underground, they get notified. They pay a per-ticket fee, and that essentially pays for that whole operation. You need to understand also that the one-call system is merely the communications hub, the centralized communications of all that. The actual marking of the lines out in the field, that's all done by the utility companies or their contractor, and that's a separate. They handle that cost separately. The fees that operate the one-call system come in from a per-ticket charge based on the number of tickets called in.
Mr. Roosevelt, what is the connection between MinOps and the Gopher State One Call? Who oversees Gopher State One Call, and who manages that, say, should there be problems with the system?
Mr. Chair and members, the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety enforces the Gopher State One Call law, and in part of that law, there's an implied, there's a sort of general overview of the system in that law. It's not a direct, very specific, other than an annual review of the operation. The board of directors of the one call system, one of the members is sitting over there in the audience, as a matter of fact, there's a board of directors that come from all of the different types of utilities that are out there. That are being charged all these fees and have these utilities in the ground, from everything from landscaping to rural electric to natural gas to the pipeline refineries and pipeline companies. They all have representatives on this board, and that's the board that really governs and operates that whole system. And then MinOps has the oversight of the issues surrounding the center.
Thank you. Senator Hall?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I need to go back here, but can you tell me what Gopher State One's budget is, then what their annual cost is, and then if you would also explain the looks like the majority of the expense in the pipeline safety budget is pipeline safety expenditures by activity, and if you could just explain that a little bit.
Mr. Chair and members, I cannot off the top of my head tell you what the Gopher State One call budget is, but I will absolutely get it for you. I'll pass it through the committee.
Mr. Rosendahl, in that process, would you give us an indication of the number of employees there and within Gopher State One call management, and right down to the people who are answering the telephone calls, and just kind of a structural view into that organization too for us?
Mr. Chair and members, and possibly Mr. Thaden would help me with some of the numbers. He's been around on that board for longer than I have. The center, which is in Chanhassen, a general manager and a number of IT staff to keep up all the maps that the utilities bring in, some clerical help, and that's pretty stable number. That's a relatively few. The number that fluctuates quite dramatically is what they call the call takers or customer service reps, and that is adjusted based on the type of year. They have fewer, certainly in the wintertime. They'll start gearing up, increasing, doing training, and bringing in additional staff at this time of year to start gearing up for the April. We get rid of the snow, the digging season this year, and then throughout the summer months. So that fluctuates and. I don't know. That's in they'll have 20, probably 20-some call takers, you know, at a normal time frame. They have a system set up where the call comes in, and it just keeps going down the line to the next available call taker. They have a backup system. If all of those lines are busy, the board monitors how long people might be on hold. They have a separate system for emergency tickets where something has happened and a utility needs an emergency ticket to get everything marked. So it's a pretty well-run system, really.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rosendahl. Appreciate the insight into that. Senator Dibble?
Are we moving on?
We're moving on, yes.
Oh, okay. I'm just going to ask just a unrelated question. I see Chief Janowski is in the audience, and we had a couple of troopers injured in the last couple of days. I was wondering how they're doing.
We could ask Colonel Jasky to come up. And
for the record, Mark Janowski, Chief of the Minnesota State Patrol.
Welcome to the committee. Senator Dibble?
I was just concerned about the troopers that were injured in the snowstorm. Just wondering how they're doing.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the snowstorm, it seems like it's been an entire winter of snowstorms for us. In fact, the Minnesota State Patrol, we had another one struck this morning down in the New Ulm area, and that makes, since January 1, 14 of our cruisers that have been struck parked alongside the road helping motorists either off the road or investigating crashes. Trooper Bell, who was struck up in the St. Cloud area last week, went to the hospital. He was knocked unconscious, but he's going to be okay. We had Trooper Lewis, who was struck down in the Red Wing area, as a matter of fact, last night. Is okay. And then the trooper, my understanding, down in New Ulm, went to the hospital this morning as well, but he's going to be all right. Thank you for your concern.
All right. We'll convey our concern and our well wishes to them.
Thank you. Thank you.
Senator
Sharon?
I think that the injury this morning occurred between Nicollet and North Mankato on Highway 14.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it could very well. I looked at it, and the station boundary that was there, I was out of the New Ulm station, so it's down in our Mankato district, could very well be.
Senator
it's
Perry? Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I'll hand it off to Senator Perry.
I was going to say
didn't mean to interrupt your comments there.
She was just helping set up the funding for Highway 14 this year. this is different related. If somebody wants to ask the chief something else, I've got another question for the acting commissioner.
Thank you, Chief.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, Acting Commissioner, can we go back to the transfer of health insurance reimbursement? My question, Ms. Ellingson, is by taking those funds out of by taking out of general funds and now taking that 1.367 out of the special revenue fund, is the intent then to spend down the $9 million that's in that fund? Is it and continue to spend that down?
Ms. Ellison?
Mr. Chair, Senator Perry, the intention is to cap the amount of money spent on that program at $1.367 million per year and to continue to pay for that particular program with those funds, but it's not to increase the amount every year. It's to keep it the same amount that it is currently.
Correct. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. So is it my understanding that we're actually switching revenue streams in from the general fund to the fire premiums and assessments that we get from homeowners? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Perry, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Ellingson, so the 1.367 that we now release from the general fund, what happens to that money?
Mr. Chair, Senator Perry, that is a savings to the general fund to meet the governor's budget targets.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Ms. Ellison. Appreciate the presentation and all of the information today. Once again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
There being no other business before the committee, we stand adjourned.